the 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver. Brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this session on access to resources. And we're looking at the angle of making macroeconomic policies work. For what? To accommodate the much more needed resources for an effective response to HIV/AIDS. My name is Elash C, and I'm with the UNDP HIV/AIDS program. And it's my pleasure to co-chair this session with a great colleague of mine, Alan Whiteside, who I've known as a colleague, as an activist on HIV/AIDS, as an academic, who kind of changed the course of his academic career and content of work because of his confrontation with the HIV/AIDS epidemic and his desire to respond to it effectively. Then he became a friend and then a brother because he's from Swaziland, he's from South Africa, he's from Africa. And I could say a lot about Alan. But I just tell you that he's now heading a very innovative program that he has founded himself, which is known under the acronym of HERD, which is the Health Economics and HIV AIDS Research Division in Durban, South Africa. And also have the privilege to be joined on this podium by a very eminent panelist, namely a colleague, Andy Burke, the chief of the Division of Policy Development and Review at the International Monetary Fund. John Kamigwe, who is the deputy director for policy and strategy at the National AIDS Control Council in Kenya. My own colleague from UNAIDS, Robert Greener, the economics advisor. And Leonard Ikola for the international head of HIV/AIDS at ActionAid. I just tried to reflect on the issue, and I remember that when I started working on HIV/AIDS many years ago, we were counting the total investment in responding to the epidemic in millions of dollars, maybe with the fingers of one hand. And those funds were managed globally, given to a certain number of priority countries, which all designed programs that all look alike. And I remember at the time they were called STPs, short-term plans. A couple of years later, the same international community and come back and say, no, what you need is not a STP, but a MTP, medium-term plan. And maybe $1 million more was added to it. 1 year later, we come back to them and said, no, what you need is a MPT2, which is the second generation of medium-term plan, and a $1 or $2 million added to it. Then we, the same people, come back again and say, oh no, what you really need is a strategic plan and a strategic framework. And then, you know, the money didn't follow. Suddenly, then we realize that costing is necessary. Suddenly, we realize that scaling up is necessary. Suddenly, we realize that it is beyond health, but should be addressing everything else that goes with it. And thanks to activists, thanks to NGOs, thanks to people living with AIDS and then community on the ground crying loud for the greater need for resources to respond to the magnitude of the epidemic, more and more resources were coming in. UNAIDS was then created in 1996, and then we were estimating $300 million invested in the developing world. 2001 at NGAS, when we estimated that we needed anything between 7 to 10 billion, I will always remember the first draft we put for negotiation. The people said, look, this is really crazy. It will never happen. 1 year later, the Global Fund was created. today we think that there are a couple of billion dollars from the Global Fund in 130 plus countries. And if we are really successful to experience what really universal access means in a developing world, we are talking about anything between $20 to $25 billion, which will be needed. When we reviewed in 2006, where we were at in resource mobilization, we were almost on target, $8.3 billion, from an estimation of anything between $7 to $10 billion. And I don't think it's an illusion when we think I'll say that we can project to mobilize as much as over $20 billion. This is an epidemic which is still existing in every part of this continent, of this world, and it's expensive. We realize that the majority of people living with AIDS still do not know that they're HIV positive because the incentives of knowing are not very high if really access to treatment is so limited in many parts of the world. Of course, it does reveal many dysfunctionalities and constraints related to capacity, but it also has demonstrated that it is possible, because even in resource-poor settings, where capacity is low, when it is carefully planned and carefully managed and all the stakeholders put in place, then we realize that a difference can be made. But with the influx of new resources, also other concerns are being raised from different corners. You know, a fear of another disease, which is named after a very wealthy country, which is a Dutch, so-called Dutch disease, is threatening sometimes, you know, our response, you know, to HIV/AIDS. The question is, will the new influx of resources destabilize the macroeconomic framework in those countries? Will it? I think our experts will tell us if it will or not. If this is being used as the true analysis, or is it being used as an alibi for either receiving countries to forfeit their own contribution to the national budget to AIDS, which is going to be a substitution and defeat the whole purpose of additionality that we wanted? Or is it being used also as donors that for the sake of fighting inflation or looking at foreign exchange appreciation, you know, one will be using arguments such as medium-term expenditure frameworks and budget ceilings and all the other complicated work that none of us will understand, that we will not, you know, put that resources on place, will it? I hope that the panel will help us also, you know, respond to that. Will we also define exactly what influx of new resources is? If we realize that in most of the developing countries, it doesn't matter how big the grant is, it is not a check. Or all those resources coming into the country, they come in forms of Toyotas or Olympus microscopes or Canon photocopiers or other drugs, which are certainly not produced in those countries that are receiving the money. So it will be certainly interesting to reflect, out of the billions of dollars we are talking about, what is the exact amount in terms of cash that is coming into the countries and into the budget that will endanger any macroeconomic framework. Let me now, with those questions, first of all, thank you, Alan, for joining us, and ask Alan to take on, give us a few remarks and introduce our speakers so that we get your first insight. And often, and hopefully we will have some time for real interaction in debating those issues. Alan.
Yes, thank you very, very much for those very generous remarks. I have the same opinion of you, and I think it is fair to say that us is not only an outstanding person, but he stands out, as those of us who try to follow him through convention centers realize. The commonality that we have on this panel is that we're all economists, except for us, and we're all male. And we're aware of that.
Except.
Including us. There is a session going on in parallel with this, which is called Women Taking Charge of the Response. I just make this as an observation. It is happening next door. When we were here coming into this, Ass turned to me and he said, I didn't expect very many people to come to this. And when we sat up here and looked around the room, he said, I didn't believe, why are there so many people who actually want to come and hear economists? And I had to say to him, look, you're confusing supply and demand. How we meet the market will be determined by whether or not people walk out of the door, because that is the only mechanism that we have. So I'm very much trusting that we are going to have an interesting set of presentations, and we will also have useful and probing discussion. So with those opening remarks, I would like to invite Andy Berg to give his remarks. He is the Division Chief of the Policy Development and Review Department at the International Monetary Fund, has a PhD in economics from MIT, and previously worked at the US Treasury, and worked also as the Deputy Assistant Secretary in East Asia and Latin America. And I should just finish by saying that we did debate on whether or not we would swap the tie around depending on who was speaking, but we decided not to. So, Andy, over to you.
Thank you, and thank you for that kind introduction. It's an honor to be here. This is an important topic. I'm going to try and stick to my 10 minutes so we can have lots of exchange, because I'm sure many people have questions. The introduction was very helpful because I hope I'm going to try and respond to several of those questions about how could there possibly be problems if the money's available. It should be the case that spending money to fight AIDS is a win-win proposition. This slide just outlines some of the main conclusions from a book we published at the IMF a couple of years ago about the macroeconomic impact of AIDS. I'm not going to go into detail because we know perfectly well that AIDS is devastating economically as well as directly to health and socially. So spending money to cure AIDS ought to help with growth, help with poverty reduction, help with even fiscal balances, because when people work, they pay taxes and so on. I think we found, just went to a seminar this morning that pointed out how, and I think this is really remarkable, how quickly people return to the labor force when they're treated with AIDS. And that's an important study. And there are other, we also know that often those afflicted with AIDS are right above the poverty line in many countries. So that while AIDS hits growth, it disproportionately affects, tends to disproportionately affect poverty. So why is there a problem? Well, first, before we get to why is there a problem, let me say that the IMF, in fact, we view our job as being to help countries spend money to fight AIDS, spend money effectively, and to overcome the obstacles that may stand in their way. We are fully engaged in implementing the MDGs, of course, one of which is to fight AIDS. AIDS prevention and treatment are part of the PRSPs, the Poverty Reduction Strategy papers that we are engaged in, and which governments, various stakeholders, donors are also engaged in helping define a common development agenda. IMF country reports frequently address the need for more resources for AIDS. To be a specific point that may come up, IMF programs treat aid, including aid grants for HIV, as revenues in the budget. So if there's a target on the fiscal deficit, that does not serve to limit spending of aid for HIV AIDS or any other purpose. And of course, we aim to promote long-run growth, which is a critical component to fighting AIDS and other MDGs. So why is there a problem? Despite the potential win-win situation, it's the case that resources are scarce in a given country at a given point in time. There are potential tensions between multiple objectives, and I'm going to talk about two or three, depending on time. One is what people call fiscal space. competing needs in low-income country budgets, and how much can you spend overall? And then what was alluded to as Dutch disease, and something maybe about debt and volatility, if I have time. Fiscal space is about the fact that there's only so much money that can go around. When a government decides to spend money, it can spend money from domestic taxes, from external grants, from external or domestic borrowing, and it can print it and spend it, essentially. And those sources exhaust the possibilities. Some are better than others. And fiscal space is about how this identity adds up in practice. In our view, expenditure from domestic taxes is often a useful thing. Taxes are hard to raise. You want to do it in a way that is efficient. It doesn't choke off private sector activity and so on, and it takes time. But we encourage many countries to try and raise their domestic revenue base. Grants are the best way, really, to increase expenditure. Concessional external borrowing also. Now, domestic or, for that matter, foreign non-concessional borrowing, by which I mean borrowing at market interest rates, has its place and can be used to some extent, but on the whole is a fairly limited way to finance the kinds of scale of expenditure that are needed for AIDS. And that's simply because none of us want to see a repeat of the sorts of debt crises that we've observed over the last many years, and we don't want to see interest payments absorb an increasing share of government expenditure. Inflation is generally not a very good source of government finance. Some of it is, but the key point I think I want to make about inflation, it's not so much a question of whether inflation should be 6% or 10% or 3%. There's just not a lot of money there. On average, of course it varies by country and so on, but if countries go from 6% inflation to 15% inflation, and do so in a way where they sort of print money and buy stuff, and that drives up the inflation rate, they would get about 0.5% of GDP in extra purchasing of goods out of that. That's just not very much compared to the scale of what's required and what is possible through aid. Now, let me talk about some of the concerns, the critical issues that come up when we think about how to divide up this fiscal space. First of all, there are compelling needs at a given point in time. For example, infrastructure is obviously critical for growth. Indeed, infrastructure may be critical for developing the sorts of economic possibilities that allow you to expand higher education, that allow you to educate nurses, that allow you to deliver AIDS drugs. So it gets very complicated in the sense that these things need to go together. Of course, there are other social sector needs, such as education. And in the world, not at the IMF, but the exceptionality of the health argument is not universally accepted, including obviously in recipient governments. The idea that health comes first. I'm going to talk about a tricky concept which we call fungibility, which was alluded to in the introduction, which is that it really comes from the idea that recipients and donors may have different priorities. Suppose donors want to give $100 to increase spending on AIDS. Now, suppose the government would rather spend it on a power plant because that's what's critical to getting the economy growing in their view. They can reduce domestic spending on AIDS, increase domestically financed spending on the power plant by $100, and achieve their purpose of allowing that aid money to, in effect, be used for the power plant. When this is because let's assume they've hit their ceiling on how much domestic resources they can spend. They're already spending all of it. They're switching it now. Now, when accused by donors of cutting or not spending adequately for AIDS, they can say that's our budget ceiling. That's the problem. And in a sense, of course, that's true. If they had more domestic resources, they could do both. But for a given amount of domestic resources, is it the budget ceiling or is it the difference between preferences of the donor and the recipient? And that can create difficult problems in how one looks at fiscal space. a lot of issues in fiscal space that face finance ministers and are complicated have to do with today versus tomorrow. Now, again, the first principle is that is it spending money to fight AIDS now helps people now, which helps people now and tomorrow. Nonetheless, ministers worry about situations in which aid funding is volatile, uncertain, unpredictable, conditional, maybe politically conditional, and worry about, for example, hiring people into the government budget who cannot essentially be fired on the basis of this uncertain funding, or they and so on. There are also ripple effects that make things very complicated. Suppose the government cannot easily raise wages for nurses without also raising wages for police or the army. Donors don't want to see the money going into the army, in effect. And this raises difficult management challenges in how to scale up. Dutch disease. Fiscal space we can think of as a shortage of money. Dutch disease, in a way, is very similar. It's a shortage of domestic resources. It's a shortage of skilled local people. Because aid, what can aid do? Aid can bring in Toyota trucks. It can bring in medicines. It can bring in things you can buy with dollars. It doesn't bring you more nurses. It doesn't bring you more skilled domestic workers. It doesn't bring you more land and so on. So when you spend money, when money is spent on AIDS, to the extent that's importing drugs, is really not a problem. But to the extent that's hiring from a limited pool of skilled workers, there are trade-offs. Those are workers who are not going to be working in the private sector generating growth. It's not people who are going to be working in education and so on. At the fund, we don't believe this is a reason to avoid scaling up for AIDS. On the contrary, but we do think that it does mean that it does raise the stakes, essentially. If the resources that go into HIV/AIDS fighting work, fantastic. If they don't, it's not just a waste of aid money. It's a waste of the most scarce resource of all. And I am going to close with one picture, despite the fact that I'm out of time, which is not much to do with AIDS directly, anything to do with AIDS directly, which is a picture of real income per person in Senegal since 1970 through more or less last year. And of course, it declined depressingly for 25 years. And what happened in 1994 is that the exchange rate was devalued. It was a very wrenching political decision. The exchange rate was devalued against the dollar substantially. And you can see this really incredible growth since then. And the first time they've had it since independence, they've had sustained growth. Why did the devaluation do that? Well, I saw a paper by Jean-Paul Azam, a French economist, who argued that the reason is that devaluation slashed public sector wages, is what it did, because they were fixed in local currency terms, so slashed them in dollar terms. And that had perhaps two effects. One is it freed up some resources for public investment instead of going into wages, public wages. And second, it made working in the private sector much more interesting relative to queuing up for government jobs, or in fact working in the government. And that may have led to some research, some activity in manufactured exports. Now, so this sounds abstract, this idea that these trade-offs matter, but this growth of Senegal from 1994 really is an incredible story about development. And of course, in the end, fighting AIDS is about development. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Andy, for that presentation. And thank you also for skipping slides. We'll move straight on to the next presentation, and then we'll take questions at the end. That example from Senegal was particularly interesting, and I'm sure Ask will make comments on that, since that's where he's from, and he may have some insights into the graph. It's my pleasure to welcome next to the panel, off you go, Robert. Next to the panel, Robert Greener, who is at UNAIDS. Robert was in Botswana at the Botswana Institute for Development Policy Analysis, which is where we first worked together on the issue of HIV and AIDS, and he currently is the economics advisor at UNAIDS, and I would point out he is the only economics advisor at UNAIDS, which is something of a problem, I think, for both them and for us.
And when I said yes, I didn't think. No, a bit tough.
Thank you, Alan, and thank you for the plug, and thank you for the opportunity. I'd like to start with a very brief overview of the state of the global epidemic, without going into any detail. There are just two main points I want to make. One is that the bulk of HIV infection is in the poorer countries of the world and is still rising in many areas. And the second is that there are more new infections, 4 million new cases per year. There are more new infections than the number of people who die. The number of new infections is an indicator of future mortality. And this illustrates that demographic impact has not yet peaked and will still be evident for many, many years to come. We have a long-run problem here, as we all know. Now, any discussion of how to make money work has got to begin with a consideration of how much money is actually needed. Now, this shows the estimates from UNAIDS that reflect the cost of a fully comprehensive response in all low- and middle-income countries to 2008, as reported this year to the UN General Assembly High-Level Meeting on AIDS. Now, these estimates are far from perfect, and they have their detractors. But they are an indicator of the order of magnitude that we should be thinking about. They're somewhat larger than currently planned or expected expenditures in countries. And this is important when we think about possible macroeconomic impact. What would happen if countries spent what they actually need to spend rather than what they're currently planning to spend or feel able to spend? Now, this chart, I'm not sure if you can read it, and it might be better if you can't. In fact, this chart shows what these expenditures that we're talking about would mean if you express them in terms of the percentage of GDP in the countries that you can see here. I should stress that although experts from these countries were involved in producing these estimates, the numbers don't have formal endorsement from governments. Nevertheless, they reveal an interesting picture, even though the countries might shift around a little bit here. Firstly, notice that all of them are in sub-Saharan Africa. And then secondly, in many cases, the estimated need is greater than the current health budget, or at least of similar magnitude to the current health budget. Now, we can break that down further by isolating just the treatment needs. What's the treatment need as a percentage of the health budget? This chart shows that. Now, aside from a couple of outliers at the top, the most affected countries would need to spend somewhere between 10 and 40% of their current health budget on AIDS care and treatment, even with the relatively optimistic assumptions that we've made in here about future pricing of ARV medicines. Some country-level estimates that I've seen are even higher than the ones I'm showing here. Now, this is the scale that we do need to think about if we want to assess the capacity and the macroeconomic challenges that must be met. We're looking to push a lot of resources through fragile delivery systems. But what's available for AIDS? There's been important progress in AIDS response, as has been said a lot in this conference. This chart shows the projected resources available to 2007. It's an indication, it's also very imperfect, of the current funding pipeline. Although they fall short of the estimated need, the resources have increased significantly in recent years. They're still expected to rise to about $10 billion by 2007, next year, which is about 55% of what we estimate to be the need. Now, the funding base, which is shown by the colors, has also been improved by programs like PEPFAR and the Global Fund and the World Bank, as well as by private foundations, such as that of Bill and Melinda Gates. Importantly, the domestic government funding, the red boxes at the bottom, rose to about $2.5 billion in 2005 and is projected to rise further, albeit rather slowly. Treatment access has improved, as we know, with 1.3 million receiving ARVs. There have been important commitments by the UN, the World Summit, the G8, the African Union, to the goal of universal access that I'll say a bit more about. So in summary, we now have a sufficient understanding of the epidemic, significant improvements in resources, and as has been said frequently, the challenge is now to shift the response from short-term crisis management to long-term strategic planning. So how do we do that? What are the priorities for building a sustained response and making the money work?
These are four areas which I'll go through in a little more detail. Firstly, it's important to remove the volatility of the funding stream for countries. The funding comes in big lumps, so they can implement their long-term plans. We can't ask countries to implement long-term plans if there isn't long-term financing attached to it. We need long-term, predictable, and binding mechanisms for financial contributions from all sources. And it's important to continue to diversify the funding base, including the bilateral, multilateral donors, national governments, business, NGOs, trade unions, and the philanthropic foundations. Diversity can improve the stability of the funding. So that's the first area. And the second area is the commitment to universal access. There is a formal international endorsement of the goal of universal access to prevention, treatment, care, and impact mitigation. But there is a priority to translate that into operational terms that can guide action. Now, this requires ownership at every level, and this can only be built by adapting more closely to the country-level context with full involvement of civil society. But the most pressing need in many of the affected countries is to build human capacity in every area of service delivery. The critical shortage of skilled workers is the underlying cause of poor service provision, of poor planning, poor surveillance, and poor distribution of funds. Capacity investments are critical to improvement of the AIDS response and for progress in many other development areas, including the goal of economic growth, of course. So what do we need to build capacity? And crucially, we need to expand the recruitment and training of health workers, improve working conditions and salaries in order to raise morale and efficiency and limit the brain drain to the developed world that we hear so much about. But second, we must also build the capacity within the affected countries in the critical area of strategic planning and program management. It's only in this way that we can address the perceived inability to mobilize, program, and absorb incoming revenue in the long term. We need to increase and sustain financing for training in all of these areas. We need to understand that these investments are important for broader development across the board. AIDS cannot be viewed in isolation from other development priorities. We need to move forward on a broad front. It's true that expenditure on human capacity is non-tradable. And if it's implemented widely, it will fuel domestic demand in countries. Now, if this happens in the absence of economic growth, it may indeed give rise to macroeconomic concerns that we should not ignore. There is also potential disruption in the domestic labor markets if one sector is favored over others, as Andy said. What is actually needed is broad and balanced capacity development across all sectors. We can't develop just in the area of AIDS. Now, the fourth priority is to meet the challenge to place AIDS within the framework of long-term development planning. That hasn't really happened yet. This means that the AIDS response needs to be fully integrated into national development plans, budgeting frameworks that form the basis for negotiations with the lending institutions. Strategic plans need to reflect the commitment to universal access. They need to be ambitious. HIV prevention and AIDS treatment needs to be central to the national poverty reduction strategies. And the poverty reduction effort needs to be adjusted to recognize the effect of the epidemic. Resource need assessments that, like the ones I've shown you for prevention, treatment, and care, must be integrated into the medium-term expenditure framework. And that framework should include the donor contributions that are spent through government channels. Target setting and strategic planning must be strengthened at country level through both technical assistance and capacity building. The rest we've talked about for some time now. Plans need to be coherent, adhere to the three ones principles with regard to organization and monitoring of response, with the meaningful participation of civil society. I'll conclude just by summarizing our perspective of the macroeconomic issues. We know that inflation and real exchange rate appreciation can hurt people, but so does AIDS. In this, as in other development areas, we do face a genuine dilemma. The impacts of AIDS illness and deaths are devastating, well documented. AIDS is expected to increase poverty rates in sub-Saharan Africa and elsewhere and impair the function of public and private sector institutions. And some of these impacts are already happening. We can see them, while others are not yet apparent because of the long wave nature of the AIDS epidemic. They are coming nonetheless. Responsibility for making these judgments lies ultimately at country level with national governments. Circumstances differ between countries and priorities differ between countries. The global debate that we're engaged in here about the role of international agencies is mirrored at country level by the debate between line ministries and ministries of finance. We should be seeking to exert a constructive influence over these debates by using our comparative advantage. While we look to the IMF to advise countries on matters of macroeconomic stability and finance and balance, we look equally to civil society to work in countries and influence the decisions that are taken by national governments, who are ultimately accountable to their own populations, and to the UN and development agencies to assist all of the above to build capacity at country level. We all have our part to play in overcoming these challenges within our own areas of competence and influence, and there's no shortage of work that needs to be done. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robert. And thank you again for keeping to time. He was 35 seconds over time, and for those of you who might be presenting in future sessions, there is some leeway from the chairs, but not very much at all, on seconds of time. Our next speaker is John Kamigiwa, who wrote out his own bio, which is why I'm having difficulty reading his surname. He's the Deputy Director of the National AIDS Control Council in Kenya. He's in charge of policy, strategy, and communication, and he's representing the National Minister of Health from Kenya, who unfortunately couldn't travel to be with us. And I would like to say a big thank you to him for stepping in at such short notice to give this presentation this afternoon. Okay, over to you.
Thank you very much. I'll be brief and keep to the time. My presentation is going to focus very much on issues of human resources. And may I start by saying that, as we all know, the HIV pandemic, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, has posed severe challenges to issues of economic management and resource allocation. And the impact of HIV has also severely affected the health sector plus all other sectors. Because as we know, when we talk of HIV/AIDS, it has a multidimensional impact. It touches on all sectors at the same time. And therefore, when we talk of resources, particular human resources, we are not confined to health sector resources. We are talking about addressing human resources in all the sectors because they are all affected. As we are aware, the HIV pandemic has consequences on within the health sector, on morbidity, mortality. In the wider sectors, it has impact on the increasing number of orphans and the vulnerable children. Again, within the wider sectors, it affects the economic development and growth. And therefore, when we are talking about addressing HIV/AIDS, particularly focusing on human resource, we should focus on all sectors. We know the various governments have signed various declarations in how resources are going to be allocated. Our development partners have been partners in this. By the way, resources have been addressed. The whole area of resources has been addressed. There's still a lot more that needs to be done. In order to free resources and even put in more resources to address the pandemic. Part of the problem has to do with the way we have begun to internalize the whole agenda of HIV/AIDS. Within the planning processes. Very many times we see it is looked at as just like within the resource allocation mechanisms, it is looked at not as a productive area. It is considered to be within the social sectors, which many times are considered like they are not within the productive sectors. Productive sectors are taken to be things like construction, things like manufacturing, things like those. And therefore, HIV/AIDS plus other health issues are assumed to be within the element of social service, which are seen not to be very productive to the economies. And therefore, to that extent, they are not given the emphasis they need to be given when it comes to sharing the national cake. If we are going to change the way we address HIV/AIDS, we must see it within the context that it affects every sector, including the ones which are normally considered as productive. And even more, it affects the most productive age groups within all the sectors. May I also look at how resources have been allocated within the last few decades, and how they have been affected by the various the development partner approaches to investment. Some time back, for example, in Kenya, we were meant to undergo what we called retrenchment programs. And all these were geared towards reducing government spending. And what happened, therefore, over many years, starting from the 1990s, is that personnel were laid off, actually in all the sectors, including health. And therefore, what we are seeing today being manifested by shortage of resources, particularly human resources, is what has its accumulative effect of what happened in those many years. One of the programs was called voluntary early retirement, where civil servants were given room to voluntarily leave the service. But what actually happened, therefore, is that the best who could get jobs outside are the ones who voluntarily left the service. This could be said of every other sector. And remember, this has all to do with ensuring that there is the government spending is minimized within the structural adjustment programs, which I believe were in many countries. So today we have a big deficit within the public sector, specifically in health. A study that was done in 2004 revealed that there was a big shortage of doctors and nurses within the health sector. As I said, a lot of this has been tied to ensuring that the government was operating in a manner that we were reducing government spending within the framework of structural adjustments. And I would like to point that this not necessarily the best approach when we are looking at government spending. If we are talking about macroeconomic stability, we need to look at giving the government, or looking at it from the point of arrage, whether we are talking about deficit financing or inflation. It is not a point. So We need to allow for flexibility. We need to be able to give various governments room for maneuver in order to ensure that we get more resources when they are needed, particularly to address the human resource deficits which are there. Because no matter what we do, unless we are able to put more people to work, we are not going to reverse the negative effects of HIV/AIDS. Remember, as I said, when we are talking about HIV/AIDS, it affects all the sectors. It reduces growth, and this has been documented. It affects the productivity of those people who are working. And therefore, we need to look at how best to put more human resources in all the sectors so that they are able to deliver what needs to be delivered. The other issue I would like to talk about here is the way the HIV pandemic has been addressed has been very short-term in nature. We are not yet seeing resources being channeled in a long-term manner. We need to look at how do we put more resources in a sustainable manner. We should not be planning just 1, 2, 3 year projects. We need to look at long-term programming. Because many of the issues on HIV/AIDS, which we have to address, are long-term in nature. Whether we are talking about antiretroviral treatment, or whether we are talking about the issue of orphans, we need to have a long-term strategy. In Kenya, we have the Kenya National HIV Strategic Plan, and we have estimated how much resources are needed. And these are resources that will be required in other sectors. And therefore, we need to look at how to invest in other sectors to address HIV/AIDS. And in doing so, we are talking about human resources plus all other resources. And therefore, we need to remove restrictions on employment that would hinder at delivering this strategic plan plus other strategic plans in various countries. We have in Kenya the medium-term expenditure framework. This is a framework within which various sectors are able to mobilize resources. And we believe that all the sectors need to take active participation within the MTF processes. As we know, sometime back, people thought that the issue of HIV/AIDS was just confined to the health sector. But what we are beginning to do in Kenya is to involve all the sectors to mobilize resources within the MTF process. And as I said, when we talk about mobilizing resources, we are talking about everything starting from human resource to everything else. We need to increase resources in all the sectors in order to address HIV/AIDS, including where necessary, employing more people in the various sectors. Therefore, what we are then saying here is we need a more flexible framework for injecting more resources to the fight against HIV/AIDS. Some of the economic models that have been used in the past can no longer hold. We should not be seeing the fight as a fight within the social sector. It is a fight in every sector. And therefore, we need to move by allocating resources in other sectors in order to address the HIV pandemic. Thank you very much. My time is up.
Thank you very much. We'll move swiftly on to hear from Leonard Okello, who is with ActionAid. Leonard is the international head of HIV/AIDS for ActionAid, and before joining ActionAid, he was the national coordinator for the Uganda Participatory Poverty Assessment Process, which was a partnership between government and civil society organization and donors. Leonard, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I think the interesting thing about these discussions when economists discuss is that they discuss money, they discuss business, and the human being gets a bit lost. And I just want to say, for me, this discussion is not about blaming anybody, it's not about pointing fingers, it's about laying bare the realities we are faced with so that we start thinking seriously about the solutions to this problem. I mean, that is what we need to be thinking about here. I think that's a big challenge. I lived in the Ministry of Finance in Uganda for 5 years after living in the countryside, working in northeastern Uganda where cattle rustling is the way of life, and then working with displaced people in northern Uganda, trying to solve the problem of 2 million people displaced in northern Uganda, and then working with refugees of Sudan, helping them go back home when the SPLA opened southwestern access. And it was a tough experience. I saw myself face a very tough experience. But when I came then from that rural setting to the city and worked with the Minister of Finance, I found a very interesting experience that people discussed money, people discussed business, and the human being got a bit lost. So I just want us to reflect as we go ahead in this discussion and go ahead and ask ourselves, what does it mean? I don't know where this is being sorted out from. Can I move to the next slide? Or does it come? Okay, good. Thank you. It's listening, I think. The truth about AIDS, and I think economists, government officials, and NGO activists or whatever, we need to recognize one thing. This is business unusual. AIDS has exposed human weaknesses. What AIDS has done is it exposed humanity and showed humanity that, you know what, you're not getting it right. Something is wrong somewhere. Millions are dying. And there is no sense of urgency. We must do business like we have been doing. This is the way it has been done. We're not going to change it. AIDS has told us the amount of social injustice, the amount of gender injustice it showed us. And that's the truth. And we need to face up to that and get to ask ourselves questions. What are we going to do about this? AIDS exposed failures of governments in governance, in democratization, in delivery of effective response. AIDS exposed our governments, and we need to start asking ourselves, what is the different thing we should be doing? Oh, I wish the thing could move a bit faster or something. Yeah. Can you help me with the physics of this, so I can, you know, there are not very many in northern Uganda. Oh, good. I didn't think you. There are not very many in northern Uganda, so you don't really get them. Yeah. Good. Oh, good. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Economists have something which I learned a lot in the Uganda's Minister of Finance called the Washington Consensus. And there are about 10 big things they talk about. And one of the things that is often told about in the Minister of Finance, you know, you must have fiscal discipline. Money should not be just spent like that, because if you spend like that, you're going to blow up inflation and blah, blah, blah. And then when you ask yourself a question, okay, what is driving discipline? A soldier would be driven in discipline to be able to win a war. An economist should be driven in discipline, in this case, to make sure that money is not spent. Too much money is spent. You must protect the amount of money you're spending, because so much money going out is going to blow the inflation and make sure that it will mess up the macroeconomic stability. Now, human beings are dying meanwhile. Oh, I don't know. This thing is not... I can't follow this, by the way. Can somebody help me meanwhile? Yeah. It's not in my countryside, so... Excuse me, I need to get help. Say again? Where's the space bar?
Green button goes to the next slide, and then the red button goes backwards.
Okay, so I need to... Yeah. Okay, sorry. I mean, you know, like I told you, there are not very many in northern Uganda, so just be a bit patient. Okay, talk about fiscal discipline. Talk about public expenditure priorities. You heard it a few minutes ago here. Public expenditure priorities. And so you've got to ask yourself a question, what is the priority of priorities? Because resources are scarce. In short, money is scarce, human beings are actually not scarce. I think AIDS is showing us how scarce human beings are, and we should start asking ourselves, whether we are remembering that scarcity can also be in humanity. When very useful people, educated people, highly trained, useful people for the government, for their families are dying, we should ask ourselves question. Okay, so human beings could actually be scarce. When I lost my sweetheart, a trained accountant, and left me 3 children, to struggle with one was HIV positive, I learned that human beings are scarce. And economists and government officials must remember that. Human beings can be scarce. Oh, I think I'm getting it right. They talk about tax reforms. You know, but the trouble is, when you are a person living with HIV, tax reforms means that they must, your governments might look at strengthening, I mean, broadening the tax base. Now, broadening the tax base does not mean dropping you, the person living from HIV, living with HIV, out of the tax, the broader tax base. There are many countries, there are no laws protecting you here. For you, a person living with HIV, when they talk about financial liberalization, and, you know, that means, you know, exchange rates are now being driven by the markets, whatever, it means you have to face the reality of having to find money. Because now business is the one controlling. It's the market which is controlling things now. That's the challenge you get faced up with. When we talk about a unified exchange rate, it means now, you know, it's no longer, the governments can no longer, you know, they cannot give you any special rates. Now the rates have been controlled, this is the rate which is accepted, driven by the market often. That's the challenge you are then faced up with. They tell you about trade liberalization. Who then benefits from the trade liberalization? When you are a person living with HIV, you are probably not a businessman. And if you are as poor as you are in northern Uganda, the trouble is, it is business who actually benefits from trade liberalization. It moves them. They are the ones who actually make good use of it. Now, the trouble is, business people make profits. They don't actually care very much whether you are getting treatment or not. They make profits. Somebody has to look at how you survive then. Foreign direct investment. It must, you know, the economy, it must be managed such a way that you should be able to attract foreign direct investment. Some often it is maybe factories in the cities, and if you are HIV positive, you are a worker, you are maybe a semi-skilled or skilled labor, business may not necessarily listen to your status. So that's the challenge we are faced with. That's the challenge we are all faced with. You must privatize state enterprises. We just heard about the retrenchment that took place. Often the privatization comes with retrenchment. And the business person who takes over has to make profits. So they've got to really tighten on expenditure to make profits. Now, those are the challenges we face with as people live with HIV. There's one called deregulation. Now, deregulation, you actually remove regulation that hinder economy, hinder business moving fast, so that, you know, give space for business to move as fast as possible, so that, you know, because business is the engine of growth, according to the economists. That's the language they'll tell you. Business is the engine of growth. So you must deregulate so that, you know, business, money coming in, with business coming in, you know, does not get disrupted. So, you know, that's the kind of thing. So any laws that hinder the smooth running of business, especially for attracting international business, does not get distorted. And, of course, there's property rights. And we all know, those of us who are struggling to get treatment to everybody, intellectual property rights as the biggest challenge for us is it is hitting us on whether or not we are able to access the treatment we need. And when we think of options of generics, it often limits us. That is a challenge we are all faced. So those are the great things about the Washington Consensus, which is it makes sense to economists. The reality is there is a human being which is going to face the implications of this. And so we need to start asking ourselves questions as economists. What are we doing, because this is business unusual? What are we doing unusually to address business unusual brought by HIV and AIDS? Macroeconomic stability for who? We talk a lot about macro, and I had a lot of discussion about macroeconomic stability, which is very important so that, you know, economies can run well and blah, blah, and all that. The question is, who should decide macroeconomic stability? There must be a government who is responsible to the country, to the citizens of the country. People living with HIV are actually citizens. They don't come from the moon. They are citizens of a certain country. Yes, the trouble is, often they are no longer part of the central bank gets independence. You know, there is a provision that the bank must have its space to do its job professionally so that it doesn't get interfered with by political interests. But we also know that the big challenge is when people are dying out there, what should the politician do? Because central bank is independent, central bank does not therefore listen to the challenges of many people dying of AIDS in the country. It listens to economic figures and also listens to
international economic dynamics, which is going on, which is no longer listening to the problems of the poor. Now, that's a challenge we need to think about. Then they put inflation targeting. The challenge with inflation targeting is we have not built a very clear consensus, in my view, on what exactly is acceptable inflation that can give enough resources to address HIV. That's the challenge we have. We have a crisis in which many of our governments in the South are being pushed to maintain inflation levels to below 5%. Now, if we are maintaining below 5%, sounds great, and in economics terms, sounds great, but it means resources for human resource, which you are talking about. It means resources for our treatment. It becomes difficult to get. It means sometimes when money is coming from outside, like it happened in my own country, there was a big discussion about whether we should accept this global fund money. And it took some time for us to build a consensus. Those are the challenges we are faced with, and we must ask ourselves questions as economists. What are we doing about that? We cannot continue doing business as usual in this kind of situation. We can talk, is it capital account liberalization? Oh, this is another very interesting one. They talk about capital account liberalization. You know, this is very important because, you know, money must be able to move in and out without difficulties so that, you know, there is enough money, it can attract private business, can come and do more business, and therefore, business, you know, engine of growth. Blah, that's a big word you often hear. But the challenge is, when this is liberalized, who is actually, what sense is it making for the country? Who is deciding on that? Who is helping? Who is really taking that decision? Debt sustainability. Yeah. Should it be debt sustainability or debt cancellation or debt eradication? Those are questions we should be asking ourselves as we go ahead. We talk about international business and the interest of fighting AIDS. Think about it. Just ask yourself simple questions. The politics of international business and the fight against AIDS. Well, I saw a certain very interesting graph which was put here where there was very little amount, if you saw the green part on top, contribution by the private sector. Did you see that? Remember that? Ask yourself those simple questions. Sometimes I feel there are some double standards in applications of all this, especially in the pressure of inflation. You find, if you look at it carefully, you find, you know, India gets away with quite a few things, and Zambia or little Uganda may not get away with very many things. I think if we are going to apply the rules across the board, we should ask ourselves. I think in the end, this does not look like actual economics. It looks at more of politics and trade, which is becoming the central issue here when we are taking those double standards. The question is, I keep asking myself, do the big powers all take decisions based on this? The big countries that are big business, that are big political power, do they take decisions based on the 3% inflation rate that we are being told about? This is a long-term health crisis, we have been told. Are we handling it with short-term inflation issues? One last one. Good, just about coming to an end. The future is my proposal. I think tight fiscal and monetary policies was intended, in my view, in the context of serious hyperinflation in the 80s, that was the situation then when Reagan and Thatcher were really pushing for that. That was then. But the truth, there was no AIDS that time. AIDS, the pandemic as we know now, was not there. So we should ask ourselves questions. Is it going to continue to work the same way without rethinking the way forward in the context of 40 million people HIV positive and more likely to be positive? We should ask ourselves those questions. We should ask ourselves questions. Should macroeconomic stability and the so-called reasonable space for health and aid spending, should we be thinking of it in terms of saving life or in terms of finances only? Those are the questions we'll be asking ourselves. I think negotiations with the IMF, with the World Bank, with the bilaterals, I think we should make them a little more transparent than they are at the moment. I used to sit in the Minister of Finance. And while in that participatory project, I remember very well that the negotiations, when the fund and the bank mission came into the country, then the civil society never sat in that meeting. And yet I was sitting in the Minister of Finance. Then I was a staff of Oxfam. And finally, we need to open this policy space for alternatives. We need to start thinking of alternatives, because the reality is things are bad. People are dying. Let us open space for alternative discussion. And finally, you know what? Poverty and AIDS advocates. I think we need to start engaging in serious research and engaging in serious advocacy. The reason I say this is we often stand up and blame IMF, blame World Bank, and blame the governments, and we don't put alternatives on the tables. And I've actually not put alternatives on the table, as you can see. Okay? I think the important thing is that we need to start putting alternatives on the table. I recently met a group of civil society organizations in Washington, and I found very interesting that when I asked a question about how much engagements are you doing with the Treasury and how much engagement are you using, there was a bit of anxiety in the room. I think we need to start thinking of how we engage all Minister of Finance down in the South and Minister of the Treasuries and the banks here in the North, and we get a way together to fight AIDS. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Leonard. Leonard recently spent 2 weeks on a training program in Durban as a participant and was one of the more troublesome members of the group in terms of difficult questions. So I will try to protect all the other panelists. But if anyone has a difficult question for Leonard, you're welcome to ask it. The way we will do this is as follows. We will take questions. We have 15 minutes, and then we need to wrap up. We will take questions in groups of three. We will have short interventions, which I will cut off if they are not. We will then invite the panel to respond, and we will then go back to the floor. So can I see people? And I see Hillary, 1.5 minutes.
Mike.
Are there mics? I don't see the mics. There's one over there, too. Go there. Okay. Yes. Please line up behind the mics if you have questions so I can see you.
I have a question and a challenge for Andy Berg. And my question and challenge is as follows. I think Andy said that we all know AIDS is economically devastating. I would like to challenge him and say that that may be true of many countries. There is certainly an argument about whether that is true for South Africa. In South Africa, there has been a very extensive and very detailed study. It is a poster at this conference, and I delivered it actually at the IAEN on behalf of the authors last week. And, you know, I think the IMF, developing countries face a double whammy. Not only are we hit by AIDS, but we're hit by the IMF telling us that our economy is collapsing, which means people don't invest in our country and people put their money in dollars. I really think that it's a very serious point that I think you're doing a great deal of harm by spreading that message. The challenge I would put to you is, I'm not a macroeconomist, but I would issue a challenge for you to come to South Africa and face our macroeconomists and to defend your point of view. Let's have an open
debate. Thank you very much, Hillary. That is your 1.5 minutes. I don't think anyone would put their money in dollars at the moment. You, sir.
Thank you.
They are, and the dollar is going up.
My name is Peter Mutie. I'm from Kenya. I cannot overemphasize what my friend Leonard there said. Thanks very much, Leonard. And I would like to say that I've got some little economics in my mind, certainly not at the PhD level. And I disagree with my fellow economists, especially on matters of HIV/AIDS. HIV/AIDS is not a development issue. It is a retrogressive issue. And until we look at that from that point of view, we are always going to get it wrong. Those models that we've been shown there, I am certainly sure they will not work as far as HIV/AIDS is concerned, because it is not a development issue, it is a retrogressive issue. My question is, and especially to my friend from IMF, when we get loans to fight HIV/AIDS from the World Bank and other sister institutions, are we really assisting the countries that we are giving these loans? Because, first of all, they are of a burden. Two, people are dying. It is the orphans and vulnerable children who are being left behind, and therefore overburdening these people to pay back this money at a future date. Are we helping these countries, or we are, sustaining debt?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's move on to that mic there, please.
Good afternoon. My name is John Foster from the North South Institute in Canada and the Global Treatment Action Group of Canada. I want to go to the supply side, those colorful charts that our friend from UNAIDS put up, and this issue of arriving at the sustainable and predictable flows at the levels that are needed to bring universal treatment. Where are those flows going to come from in the estimation of any of the panel? And here I quote that great French revolutionary Jacques Chirac, that many of the profits of globalization, for example, international trade and currencies, go untaxed at the moment. So what are we to do that's big enough and fast enough to provide the backup for universal access to treatment? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's take a couple of responses from the panel, and the same rules on time apply to you. Who would like to start? Andy?
I said before that I don't contribute on almost any diversity dimension, except I will be probably taking some unpopular positions. If that's diversity, then I'm contributing. Let me first respond to your comment about South Africa. First of all, one thing that's obviously very important is that we maintain open dialogue as much as possible with all development partners. There's a resident representative in South Africa who is constantly engaged with the government and with the public sector, and I urge you to contact him. And on your point about destabilizing, I don't believe that we have been destabilizing the South African economy, if that's what you're referring to, but it does raise an interesting problem, which is that we play two roles, and one of them is confidential advisor to the government. So that if we perceive a problem, so we go into a negotiation and we perceive a real risk to, for example, the exchange rate that we need to collectively decide what to do about and help. We want to help them decide what to do about it. It's precisely the sort of transparency that that some people talk about that could raise issues of destabilizing conversations. So to the extent that we're going to talk about serious things in certain contexts, it creates a problem. And so we try and carefully calibrate our public message to avoid destabilizing the situation, and on the contrary, to help.
Okay, thank you. We'll move on. Anybody else from the panel want to respond? Robert?
Yeah. Does this turn on? Oh, yes, it does. Okay. Well, I was asked, how do we arrive at sustainable and predictable flows of financing? It's a very difficult question. But I think what I showed was that resources do actually exist. We're somewhere around 50%, slightly more, of what we claim we need. And by the standards of development problems, that's quite impressive. So resources are actually out there. And the key to keeping them flowing in a sustainable way is diversity, so that we don't all rely on one donor. We don't rely on the United States taxpayer or whoever else. We actually have multilateral channels that these things go through, that the Global Fund is properly financed, and that we continue to get sustained donations from charitable foundations, as we are getting. So the answer is a difficult answer, but it's more of the same as what we require. But we do actually have resources out there. That isn't really the bottleneck. The bottleneck is the capacity to program it and spend it effectively.
Thank you, Robert. Let's move to microphone number two, Nikki.
Nikki Natris, University of Cape Town. I was struck by the fact that this concern about inflation is very much the child of full employment models, whereas if you look at Southern Africa, which is characterized by very high HIV prevalence and very high unemployment, actually you need to take into account the fact that you've got quite a lot of spare capacity just sitting there. So you could, in fact, inject demand through capacity building, especially without having an inflationary shock. And I'd like to have some comments from Robert Wiener and Andy Berg on that.
Good. Thank you, Nikki. You, sir?
Well, good evening. My name is Lulwik from Southern Sudan. My question is going to my friend from Northern Uganda. You know the setting very, very well in Sudan. And you know about our government. It's just a new government. So what's happened with our government when they have a CPA, the peace, that you may be well aware of that one. They put a lot of money with the global, with the World Bank to do a lot of projects, like a water project, roads and others. And we know that the HIV/AIDS is not going to be fought in isolation. It's about the clean water, about the public health and others. But now that's the World Bank put a lot of obligations and turn on the money that's supposed to go to those projects. They're not doing those projects because they believe some violation was done from our government. They did not follow A and B and C. Things that with intention that they're going to block us. What do you think we should advise our government in this point? The second question is about...
Sir, I'm afraid we do need to move on, so let's just have one question. Let's move to that mic, please.
David Gartner with the Global AIDS Alliance. A question about wage ceilings for the IMF. I actually want to offer you a chance to be a hero today. It's pretty clear to us and to all the people implementing on the ground that these wage ceilings are a major obstacle to the effective scale-up of AIDS, of the fight against AIDS, and frankly, to getting kids in school as well. At least one country in East Africa, IMF has an explicit exception when there's resources for education or for health. There's no reason why there couldn't be a guidance issued by the IMF. In fact, your colleagues admit that these wage ceilings are not a particularly effective tool at this time. So will the IMF commit to issue a guidance to allow health and education spending as exceptions to these wage ceilings?
Thank you. And microphone number one, I think I see Stephanie.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Nixon with the University of Toronto and shortly the University of KwaZulu-Natal. I wanted to make a reflection based on the comments that Leonard made about the experience on the ground of policies in line with the Washington Consensus and suggest that this is something that advocates in the North should be paying attention to as well. Certainly using the case study of Canada, our country has a dual commitment to both being a good global citizen and responding well internationally to AIDS, as well as being a competitive international player in the neoliberal economic market. And when policies come into conflict, unfortunately, it's the latter that trumps the former. So for advocates in the North, I would propose that as an activist movement in HIV, we've done a great job of critiquing health and development policy and a very weak job at looking at Canada's trade and economic policies, both bilaterally and multilaterally, and these are lessons we can learn in terms of targeting our impacts in the future.
Thank you very much. We'll keep going with a few more questions at microphone number two.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Cohn, and I'm a physician in the United States, and I'm nowhere near macroeconomics. But from my viewpoint, in terms of a healthcare provider and a healthcare advocate, it's obvious that the health budget ceilings, it's not a question of if we need to lift them, but when we're going to lift them and how. So I challenge you to, in lay terms, please explain to me what your timeline might be for lifting the sectoral spending ceilings.
Okay. And that's well done. Thank you very much. And thanks for keeping it brief. Microphone number one.
Yeah, I'm Dr. Tungesje from Uganda. And my question, I think, goes to somebody from IMF. And I wanted to know when the Marshall Plan was put in Europe, did they consider some of these things like MTF, ability to absorb these funds? Because to me, in Africa, where you have more than 2 million people dying in a year, and you know, IMF comes to these countries and say, don't accept this money to distort your macroeconomic environment. Does it make sense? You know? Yeah? In Uganda, and I want to thank Leonard, just one more comment.
Please.
You know, we've been told we must control inflation, control growth, within about, in the range of about 5%. But when you calculate at that growth rate, it will take us more than 30 years to double economy, but we are taking 20 years to double our population.
Thank you. I'm afraid we need to finish now. I must hand it back to the panel. I'm sorry to the people for the people who are standing at the microphones, but we do have to wrap this up, so I'm going to hand it back to the panel. There will be no more questions. I do apologize for that. I'm going to give each of the panelists 30 or 40 seconds to respond to the comments, and then I'm going to hand it back to Sai for the final concluding remarks. Starting with you, Leonard.
Okay, thank you very much. My comrade from South Sudan, I lived and worked in Northern Uganda and South Sudan, so I know what you're talking about. I know the war front on the crisis. For me, sustainable financing or donor support or whatever should be sustainable, stable, and flexible enough to address the realities of a country. What we are talking about, and I hear a lot of talk about sustainability, stability, but I don't hear about flexibility of the type of money we get to get us to do. Because the monies that come with tight conditionalities
actually, in my view, explain the so-called lack of capacity. Because I do not understand how a government official, a district planner, I was working in Kitgum district, northern Uganda at that time, and the district finance controller had 69 bank accounts for each donor country, bilateral donor differently, supposed to 69 bank accounts, and he's supposed to struggle to fill reports of different budgets, of different lines, and he's supposed to have no capacity. It gets me very worried. That's my only comment. Thank you.
Okay, let's move to Andy.
I'll do what I can in 30 seconds, in no particular order. First, we do not tell countries not to accept the money, as I tried to say. Marshall Plan was 1 to 2% of GDP. We're talking, Mozambique's gotten 20% of GDP for 20 years, so it's just a different problem. On inflation, there are real questions about an appropriate target for inflation, and we, I believe, are flexible. As I tried to say in my speech, this thing is essentially a non-issue. Inflation does not create resources that will solve all the problems we're trying to solve. Mostly, we believe, it costs you resources in the end because it's very destructive. At most, it gets you a little tiny bit of domestic resources. So I think it's not macro stability. It's not macro stability versus fighting AIDS. Of course, if that were the choice, we would all choose fighting AIDS. It's fighting AIDS the best way, as well as educating and everything else we want to do. On debt, what about debt? Should debt have to be repaid? Of course not. As we have said, it should. The more grants, the better. Going forward, you can lend $100 or you can grant $50. You can build $100 worth of roads or $50. If you lend, you do more. There's a basic advantage of loans. But of course, grants avoid the risk of debt relief or of debt crisis down the road.
So okay, thank you very much.
I guess I'm sorry. I'll be here for a few minutes afterwards if you want to discuss some of the things.
Thank you very much. A lot of comments have been raised, and I agree with many of them. We need to move away from loans for financing HIV/AIDS. We need to expand our scope of injecting resources to the fight, and therefore the whole issue of ceilings need to be taken seriously and the restrictions removed. Issues of wage ceilings are driving many qualified personnel to the developed countries. It is an issue that needs to be sorted out very quickly. The whole issue of stability is not, as I said, it's when we talk of stability, we need to think of a space. We need to think of a range, and therefore we should not be tied to just a point, say 5% or so for inflation, and that would release a lot of resources to the fight. Therefore, we need a totally new way of looking at how we inject resources to the fight. Thank you very much.
Thank you. There was a question about whether African economies have high unemployment and therefore spare capacity, and that's true, but unfortunately that capacity is not in the skill areas that we need at the moment. And capacity building across the board is the key to improvement in all of these areas, and perhaps there are no shortcuts. We can't simply advance one sector, the health sector, and that may very well be destabilizing to economies. But if we can put forward capacity investments that demonstrably lead to improved productivity and growth and improved well-being of human beings, and those investments are attached to a long-term plan with long-term financing attached to it, then to the best of my understanding, the IMF has no problem with that, and neither does the Ministry of Finance.
Thank you very much, Robert. I'm going to now hand over to my friend and colleague to summarize the impossible task of summarizing the discussion, but I would like to slightly abuse my position up here and say a big thank you to the people who made this session possible, and I think of our colleagues from UNDP, Caitlin Weston, Karen Santi, Florian Hubner, who put forward the proposal and made this whole thing possible. So now over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Alan. So, and I thank you particularly for introducing me as the non-economist at this table. So I will take the foolish freedom to make some foolish questioning. So, how do you say that? the funding is volatile and it needs to be predictable. And many other things, you know, needs to be in place, you know, maybe, you know, until we start responding effectively to the epidemic. We certainly welcome the suggestion, as it has been put by our dear colleague, Robert Kriener, that we need long-term binding mechanisms for funding. This is pretty much welcome, and we should all mobilize, you know, to support that. However, let's not use that as an alibi for inaction. We will never have everything in place before starting doing what we should do. The day developing countries will have everything ready to respond, they will cease to be developing countries and become something else. Thank you, Andy, indeed, for putting you know, the long term and then the short term. And it is certainly some trade-offs that needs to be done today and then tomorrow. And I think it is in that perspective that we need to address many of the questions that has been raised. But I think that was an economist who said that in the long term, we are all dead in a way. And that is Keynes. Sustainability, I think, is certainly an issue. But I think looking at what, you know, needs to be done, and again, no alibi for inaction if sustainability is raised as a red flag for taking action. Fully agree. And I think we heard very interesting questions in terms of trade-offs and suggestions around that. 4% increase in inflation versus 2% decrease in prevalence and incidence. Isn't it a good deal? Now, certainly, it is a decision that needs to be made at country level, and then this process needs to be facilitated so that countries know exactly what they get into, you know, by making those decisions. And putting the human dimension, as it has been put by Leonard, is certainly extremely, extremely important. I just wanted to thank, first of all, Andy, before I forget, I will copy the Senegal graph, because I would like to share it with all these people who are contacting me every other week to get in touch with them through Western Union. And I think that, you know, show them how good, you know, they're doing at a country level. But I would like to thank, you know, very, very sincerely and dearly all colleagues for your time and your generosity, for coming here, sharing your knowledge, your expertise, and then helping us all to better understand, you know, what are the different challenges that we are facing. You know, thank you also to all colleagues that make this session possible. Thank you for the Kaiser Family Foundation for webcasting this session to allow a broader audience, you know, to get in touch with us. And also let me announce that colleagues of mine and in UNDP with the Brazil Poverty Center and the HIV/AIDS group are engaged in these kind of discussions, and then sometime later this year, many of you will be getting some information on how to engage further in building a critical mass in a discussion to better understand these issues and then mutually reinforce our capacity to efficiently address that. Let me then thank you all. If it is one lesson that I can draw from all these debates, that is only together and taking into account the different perspectives and then taking into account the urgency of the situation and an urgency because of the very nature of the epidemic that we're making a difference. Thank you again, Alan, and thank you for your support, and then thank you.